Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Whether to legalize assisted suicide and euthanasia is one of the most culturally contentious and important public policy debates of our time. Supporters of legalization call it a compassionate, quote, last resort, means of preventing unnecessary suffering. Opponents like myself see the intentional termination of the ill as abandonment and a path to allowing death on demand. How did the so-called right to die become such a visible issue? My colleague, Dr. Richard Weikart, has the answers. Weikart is Emeritus Professor of History at California State University Stanislaus and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He has published 8 books, including The Death of Humanity, From Darwin to Hitler, and Hitler's Religion. He has lectured at many universities and other venues in the United States, Europe, and Africa. He has been interviewed on dozens of radio shows, podcasts, and TV, as well as appearing in 8 documentaries, including Expelled with Ben Stein. His current book is Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing. Richard, welcome to Humanize.
Yeah, thanks to have you on, Wesley.
You're a history professor. What got you interested in history?
Well, I got interested in history a couple of different ways, but one of the things was in the 1970s, when I was in the late 70s, when I was an undergraduate, I read a number of works by Francis Schaeffer, a Christian thinker who wrote a good deal about the way that ideas had shaped our culture. And that really got me intrigued in, especially interested in intellectual history, how the history of ideas have formed our culture. And so I studied European intellectual history at University of Iowa in the late 80s, early 90s for my PhD work, and then began working on issues. And I actually wasn't thinking about this issue that strongly at the time, but I was thinking about the history of ethics, and I was very interested in how moral thought had been shaped. And as I got into some of my research, I got into a book project about evolutionary ethics in the late 1990s and early 2000s that ultimately came out in 2004 as my book, From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism. And as I got into the book about evolutionary ethics, I started realizing that a lot of these people were using evolutionary ethics to devalue human life. And so it was leading into the eugenics movement. It was leading into euthanasia at that time already in the late 19th century, and also scientific racism. And so I dealt with those issues in my book, From Darwin to Hitler, and that got me interested in this broader issue of devaluing human life. And so then in 2016, I published a book, The Death of Humanity, in which I dealt with that issue at greater length, where I looked at how secular philosophies from the Enlightenment period had eroded the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic.
What do you mean by evolutionary ethics? Are you talking about the ethics that developed because of Darwinian theory?
Yes, and there were 2 different kind of ways that this got interpreted. One way of evolutionary ethics was to consider the evolutionary process itself to be the arbiter of what is good and evil. So whatever promotes evolutionary progress is good. Whatever inhibits evolutionary progress is bad. That's one way of dealing with evolutionary ethics. The other issue that was sort of, and these were intertwined issues, was the notion that ethics is simply an evolved trait that came about through Darwinian processes. And so that this makes ethics to be entirely sort of the product of random chance events over time and doesn't give it any firm foundation, certainly doesn't make it universal.
So let's talk about euthanasia and assisted suicide. You're a critic as I am. What do you find that, you know, we could talk an hour just on this question, but what do you find so objectionable about legalizing assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Well, there are quite a number of things, actually. I mean, from my own perspective as a Christian, I believe that humans are created in the image of God. And so because of that, I think that human life has value. And that value can't be determined by some particular traits that a person has. I mean, Peter Singer has been real big about pushing the notion. He's not the only one. I mean, even before him, there were bioethicists like Joseph Fletcher, for example, and others who promoted the same ideas, sometimes known as personhood theory, that you have to have certain kinds of traits to be a human being and such. So I believe that there's no particular traits. It's that human beings are all equal in God's eyes, and that because of that, that gives us intrinsic value. Now, I don't think you have to be a Christian to believe that. In fact, I actually show in some of my works in Death of Humanity, I show that there's actually a lot of philosophers who even overtly claimed that human life didn't have any particular purpose, meaning, value, or cosmic significance. They thought that we were basically an accident of time and chance, but they still somehow know deep down that we do really have value. And so I think there's even a lot of secular thinkers that understand that human life has value and that isn't just something that isn't just some trait that we have that gives us value. Again, there's some philosophers pushing that kind of idea, but I think even sometimes if you press them, they understand that there's more to it than just, you know, rationality, or Peter Singer's claim the ability to plan the future is one thing that gives human life value aside from being just a human itself. So I think very often they understand that themselves. Let me give you an example of this too, by the way. Jerry Coyne, who has is a very famous atheist. He's a professor of evolutionary biology at University of Chicago. He's actually emeritus now. He's retired. But he wrote a book called Fact Versus Faith. And in that book, he said that we should provide euthanasia or assisted suicide for people who are in throes of suffering. And he uses the example of, you know, the way we treat our pets. And he says that, you know, look, we have compassion upon our animals, and so we don't allow them to go through this kind of suffering, you know, in the latter part of their life. We put them down. And my response to that would be, well, we're not animals. There's a key difference between us and animals. Now, again, evolutionary biology sometimes tried to blur those distinctions, but even Coyne knows better if he'll think about it. For example, I mean, I know from Coyne's political perspectives what he would say to this, but if I told Coyne, hey, you know, let's go into Chicago, the city he's from, and let's round up all of the homeless people and let's incarcerate them and then let's sterilize them. And then if we can't find a home for them, we will euthanize them. You know, Jerry Coyne and all the progressive left would, you know, erupt in anger at me for even making some kind of suggestion to do some thing so dehumanizing as that. And yet, that's how we treat dogs. What I just described to you is exactly how we treat dogs. If they're out on the street, we take them, we incarcerate them, we sterilize them, we euthanize them if we can't find a home for them. And so they realize that we're not like dogs. They realize that there's a difference, and they realize, and they do have, at some level, many of them do have empathy for humanity. And so I think we can appeal to that very often too. You know, of course we can appeal to Christian notions of, you know, the sanctity of human life and such. But I think even in secular circles, we can appeal to what I think they know intuitively about the value of human life, and realizing that, you know, we aren't just animals, we aren't just the product of chance events, but, you know, we really do have some kind of intrinsic value.
Well, if you don't accept what I call human exceptionalism, which has to do with value as well as our duties, then you can't have universal human rights, because, as you pointed out, with Peter Singer, who is the bioethicist and moral philosopher about to retire from Princeton, says is that some humans have value and a greater value based on a quality of life. And you and I would say, no, you have to have equality of life, regardless of attributes or any other circumstance. Otherwise, the only people who are safe are those that who have those with power will hold are safe. In fact, the atheist Nat Hentoff, the late Nat Hentoff, who was a friend of mine, very much against euthanasia and assisted suicide, because he said, if you do that, you're ending human rights. If you end up killing sick people, people with disabilities, people who are depressed, as they do in the Netherlands, people with mental illnesses, and eventually death on demand, which is where I think this agenda leads, then the only people who are safe are those who want to live. Even though somebody may want to die, will change their minds if they receive proper care. And you do not have human equality. Let's get to the Hippocratic Oath, which I think is important here. Why did the Hippocratic School of Medicine in ancient Greece preclude assisted suicide as a proper medical practice? And I have to say, one of the things in reading your book that surprised me was that the Hippocratic Oath was not that influential at the time it was written. It certainly became influential later. So if you could address that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, the Greeks actually were debating among themselves, among the philosophers and such, as to whether or not suicide was morally legitimate and such. And Hippocrates took the stance that no, it was not. There were other Greek philosophers, by the way, who also rejected suicide, like Aristotle, although Aristotle did make a few exceptions. Socrates also made a few exceptions, although he, in general, had a negative view toward it morally. So Hippocrates came along and was trying to come up with a code of ethics relating to physicians in particular. Socrates and Aristotle were dealing with more sort of philosophical, more general questions of suicide and such in general. And so Hippocrates, though, in trying to frame the ethics, claimed that it was not ethical for a physician to be involved in a person's demise. He didn't actually, the Hippocratic Oath, of course, doesn't say anything about the person's own responsibilities about suicide, but it's talking about the physician's responsibilities. And yes, it was still under debate among the Greeks and the Romans. In fact, the Stoics, which was a very prominent philosophy among the Romans, the Stoic philosophy glamorized and glorified suicide and thought that suicide was a wonderful thing if it was done to end your own suffering and done in a voluntary way and such. So the Romans didn't sort of set aside the Hippocratic Oath to a large degree. And it was with the coming in of Christian thought, especially by the 4th century, as Christianity was going to become more dominant in the Roman Empire and late antiquity and on into the medieval times, that assisted suicide and euthanasia, as well as abortion and infanticide, was going to be banned at that time. The Hippocratic Oath itself sort of reemerged several hundred years later, sort of in early modern times, as an oath for physicians. But it was large part because of the Christian worldview that had become dominant by that time.
Yeah, Judeo-Christianity eschewed suicide and certainly assisted suicide and infanticide, you know, exposing babies on hills and so forth. Mm-hmm. That was a minority view at the time that Christianity began and when Judaism was forming, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a minority view in the first several centuries of the existence of Christianity, or in the late part of Jewish thought. It's certainly in the Greco-Roman world, the Mediterranean world, and such. So it was very commonplace. You mentioned the exposing of children. That was very common practice, especially for children with disabilities who were set out in the fields to be either die of dehydration or being killed by animals and such. Interestingly, in the very early phases of Christianity, there were some Christians who tried to rescue these children who were exposed when they had opportunity to do that. But that was when they were a minority movement. Then as they became more prominent within the Roman Empire in the course of the 4th century, when Constantine legalized Christianity, and then finally at the end of the 4th century, where Theodosius pretty much made it mandatory for the Roman Empire, then the laws were going to become more reflect the Christian ideas in this respect of the value of human life.
And that led to the concept of hospitals and caring for people, didn't it?
Certainly. I mean, again, one of the big issues in the exposing and issues of suicide and was disabilities, was people that had either lost abilities if toward the end of their life, or in infanticide, it was with babies that were born in ways that were disabled. So focusing on people with disabilities was a big part of the push for infanticide and suicide in the Greco-Roman times. The Christians, however, had a very had an attitude toward people with disabilities that was quite different, in that Christianity thought that we needed to protect and love and have compassion for people with disabilities. Jesus even mentioned in one of his parables that of a banquet that we're supposed to invite the lame and the maimed and the blind and such. And so he specifically mentions people with disabilities and encourages us to show love and assistance for them rather than shunting them aside as burdens.
Yeah, this idea of the human burden is very dangerous. Do non-Western societies have different opinions? I mean, when we talk about the issue of euthanasia, it's always in the context of Europe or Canada or the United States or Australia. You don't hear much talk about it in China, for sure, or in some of the other non-Western societies. What has been the traditional view, particularly with regard to euthanasia in some non-Western societies?
Yeah, the work that I've in my book, Unnatural Death, I'm dealing primarily with Europe and the United States, which is where I've had most of my, where I've done most of my historical work and such. But if you do look at, and so my knowledge is not as extensive about Asia and such. But if you do look at this, interesting that many of them have not allowed these practices either. There's varying attitudes. As someone pointed out to me recently, that in Japan, suicide is sometimes considered a noble thing, although not, they don't really do it. It's not usually for issues of infirmity. It's usually for more dishonor, where you're dishonored or something, and such, like harikiri and such like that. So there's differing attitudes towards suicide in different of these societies. But I do think, interestingly, that most societies, still people have an intuition that human life has value. And so there, every society has a prohibition against murder. Every society has had prohibitions against killing other people, including physicians killing them. And the whole notion of medicine that has grown up, not just in the Western tradition, but in other places as well, is that it's supposed to be bringing about healing and health and longevity for people, not trying to bring about the end of their lives.
And of course, I want to make it real clear here, we're primarily here talking about assisted suicide or euthanasia, which is a joint enterprise,
right,
in the death of someone, not somebody doing it on their own, which I think has some different issues that are probably a little beyond our scope here. But the idea of this joint enterprise, I think, is really important, because when I went to law school, I mean, you're an historian, I'm a lawyer by training, we were told very clearly and taught very clearly, you cannot consent to your own murder. And yet we begin to see that ethic starting to erode, starting, let's say, in the late 19th century, as the euthanasia movement starts to gear up. In fact, the term euthanasia didn't originally mean, you know, killing, a mercy killing, quote unquote. It meant dying in a state of grace, surrounded by your family, in a peaceful death. And the first thing the euthanasia movement did was co-opt the word euthanasia.
Exactly.
So what happened in around the 19th century, late 19th century, going into the 20th century, that changed us from a society where, you know, in those days, people could die in agony. If you got bone cancer, you could definitely die in agony. Mm-hmm. And yet there was no discussion of euthanasia to speak of, to a society today where suffering can be alleviated. It is our duty to alleviate and mitigate suffering for our fellow men and women, brothers and sisters. And yet today we're told that being killed or being poisoned, taking an overdose, is death with dignity, but dying naturally, then the implication is that it's not death with dignity.
Yeah, I think a lot of it does have to do with the secularization of our thought. And I should say at the same time that if you think about the medical profession itself, the medical profession is very torn over this issue and has been, although for much of the, certainly in the late 19th century, there really wasn't any our significant voices. There may be in a few very fringe voices, but very, very few people within the medical profession who were supporting euthanasia. Most of the support for the euthanasia movement in the 19th century, mostly from outside the medical profession. Even today, the medical profession is very often frowning on assisted suicide and euthanasia. The American Medical Association still takes a stance against assisted suicide. Now, some of the branches, like the California Medical Association, has gone neutral on it. And California, of course, has brought it. There are obviously physicians who are practicing assisted suicide in the 9 U.S. states and the District of Columbia, where we have assisted suicide. And obviously in Canada and Netherlands, Belgium, there are physicians being involved in the practice. And it's becoming more and more acceptable. And some of those, the longer that they, you know, have that legalized. So, for instance, in Netherlands and Belgium, more and more physicians over time have become sort of have found it acceptable. Whereas in the United States, there still is a lot of pushback against it here. So the medical profession hasn't even come on board completely. But there are still certainly strong minorities and some, in some cases, majorities in some places, depending on where you're at, who have promoted the idea. And beginning in the 19th century, again, I think it has to do with the secularization of society, breaking with the traditions that upheld the sanctity of human life. And so once the eugenics movement came on board, the eugenics movement was a movement to try to improve human heredity through various means. And the radical wing of that was the euthanasia movement, because they hoped that they could get rid of people with disabilities by killing them, and that would then help improve the human species. And so you have some of these radical ideas about how to improve life, improve society, and sometimes it comes down even to economic issues too. In the eugenics movement, certainly in the late 19th, early 20th century, and again, the euthanasia movement sort of sprang out of that. There was a lot of talk about eliminating people who are economic burdens on society. And we see that then creeping up again today when you get situations where people are using lots of hospital resources or insurance resources or such. And so insurance companies have a stake in this and such. And it's interesting that even people who may not be suffering themselves from these kind of problems, and by the way, it's even people who aren't suffering physically either, are sometimes seeing themselves as a financial or economic burden on society. In fact, in Oregon, where they've had assisted suicide longer than any other state in the U.S., they do surveys of people who have taken assisted suicide or got the prescribed pills. And in these surveys, they found that less than 30% of the people list either pain or fear of pain as a factor in why they wanted assisted suicide. And that's very significant, low number, because you can choose multiple factors. So each person can choose, you know, 4, 5, 6 factors if they want to. So the numbers total more than 100% when you total the percentages of the different factors. But less than a third say that pain or fear of pain is one of the factors. But over 90% of the people do list feeling like they're a burden to society or their loved ones or friends and such. And so that is a key factor. And that really builds upon ideas that the eugenics movement was building on too. I mean, the idea of assisted suicide is not a eugenics program, because these people are beyond the age of reproduction usually anyway. And eugenics was all about stopping people from reproducing. their disabled traits and everything. But the attitude of being a burden to society does, you know, come from the eugenics mentality and does come into today's euthanasia movement as well.
Yeah. When in the eugenics movement, which, by the way, was primarily politically progressive in the era. Yeah.
Yes, it was.
When they would say that there were pernicious weeds in terms of disabled babies being born, that was a term often used, then that very quickly translates into the kind of denigration of our fellow human beings that you were just describing. In fact, I think the key book that led to a lot of this, and we're going to get a little bit into what happened in Germany, was Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life, mm-hmm. Which was a book in around 1920, 1922, written by Alfred Hoch, Carl Binding and Alfred Hoch. One was a law professor, one was a medical professor, and they basically said that there were three reasons to allow killing life unworthy of life, as you put it. One was if somebody was terminally ill, one was if somebody was unconscious, and one was the what they called, quote, idiots, close quote, who were a burden on Germany. That had nothing to do with Nazism. That had everything to do with utilitarianism and eugenics. And in fact, that book influenced Hitler's thinking on these issues to the point that in 1939, after the war in Poland began, he then allowed doctors to start killing disabled babies. He didn't make them do it. He signed an order permitting them to do it, and the doctors were, by that time, so caught up in eugenics that many of them decided to go for it.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that the Nazi, as you suggested, that it wasn't just the Nazis sort of forcing this upon the medical profession. Now, to be sure, there were still many people in the German medical profession who were opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide, but there was a very strong element among the German physicians community who were supportive of it based on Binding and Hoch's ideas that had been controversial in the 1920s, but had gained ground. Karl Brandt, who was Hitler's personal physician, was going to become the leading figure in the T4 euthanasia program. And there were quite a number of other physicians that were involved. In fact, the physicians were so zealous to try to do this that they're actually in Bavaria was one asylum, mental asylum, that continued killing its inmate, its people living there, people with mental illnesses, after they were so-called liberated from the Nazis. So the Allies came in, took over those territories. They kept on killing after that time. So this is not something just the Nazi regime was forcing, you know, these institutions to do. They had a lot of collaborators that were very zealous and willing to help out with that. And interestingly, too, and this is another thing that people, a lot of people may not know about the euthanasia program under the Nazis, is that the Nazi euthanasia program was really a pilot program for the Holocaust in several ways. They piloted the methods. They began using gas chambers for people with disabilities before they used gas chambers in death camps in Poland. And a lot of the personnel that were actually involved in the T4 program of killing people with disabilities were transferred to Poland when they shut down the T4 killing facilities, which they did in 1941. By the way, they didn't stop the killing. They just shut down these killing centers to make it less obvious to the German public what was happening. And they just decentralized the program. They still kept killing people. They just did it in dozens and dozens of different hospitals and asylums throughout Germany rather than doing it in these six particular centers that they had set up. But a lot of the personnel from those six centers got sent to Poland, occupied Poland, to set up these death camps, and some of them became commandants and other officials running the Nazi Holocaust. So the killing of people with disabilities then led directly into the killing of people of different races as well.
And the thing that's quite remarkable is that you'd hear terms like this is a healing treatment from the doctors who were killing these disabled people. The idea that we're actually saving them from suffering. And as I recall, when the Holocaust, the medical Holocaust began, Jewish babies were not eligible, which is ironic, because this was supposed to be for good Germans. It wasn't the idea of, you know, the disfavored races and disfavored ethnicities. This was for good Germans. It was to help strengthen Germany, and it was considered a healing treatment for the disabled person, for the family, and for the Reich.
Yeah, and specifically, it was healing for the race in particular, because Hitler, race was everything. And so he thought that this was going to improve the human species. He thought it was going to drive evolution forward and help the German race, the Aryan or Nordic race, to become to progress biologically, get rid of what he called burdens or the dead weight that they as they saw it, that this then would bring about something better, bring about a better society, ultimately. Of course, they're doing this, again, it's very ironic, all of that, because again, they're killing these people. Of course, this is not voluntary euthanasia either. This is involuntary. This is killing people without their consent. With disabilities, it's killing people without the consent of their parents or other individuals, sometimes their loved ones, who very often didn't know what was happening until after it had happened.
When the world found out about the medical aspect of the Holocaust, which also included other things like experiments and so forth, what was the reaction of the world, and what did that do to the euthanasia movement?
Well, people were horrified by it, and rightly so, and it did lead to a revulsion toward euthanasia-assisted suicide. So in the late 1940s and 1950s, there actually was a decline in support for euthanasia-assisted suicide. By the 1930s, before Germany began their euthanasia program, in Britain and in the United States, support was growing, but it was going to have a setback because of the Nazi program. And so in the late 40s and 50s, it's not just because of the revulsion to the Nazi program. There also was an uptick in religious interest in the 1940s and 50s in the United States and Europe as well, that I think also helped to counter that. So there's moving away from the secularizing trends and such. But in the 1960s and 70s, that was pretty much going to they were pretty much put that behind them. The euthanasia movement was going to begin to slowly grow again. And so by the 1980s and 90s, you have in the Netherlands the courts mandating euthanasia. And ultimately, then right at the beginning of the 2000s, then the legislature's actually legislating it as well. So by the 1980s and 90s, the euthanasia movement is going to be picking up then again.
It seems to me, though, that there was a change in the way the message was delivered between, say, the 20s, 30s, and 40s, which was more harsh, utilitarian, denigrating of people.
Yeah.
In the new iteration of euthanasia and assisted suicide, that was put aside, and it was about autonomy and compassion.
Well, of course, in the 1960s, you know, we have this outpouring of promoting liberation and freedom and individual autonomy. And so I think that was going to really resonate with a lot of people at that time. And also, people wanted the government, they didn't want the government to make these decisions, because at this point, from what you're describing, you know, by the 80s and 90s, when euthanasia and assisted suicide is coming in, it's supposed to be voluntary at that point. And so what the Nazis were doing was involuntary. And so people are distancing themselves from that and saying, oh, this is not going to be state directed. This is going to be individually chosen by people rather than mandated by the state. And so that's supposed to somehow make it better. You know, I'm not sure that that makes it better when millions of people make a choice for death rather than a small cadre of people making a choice to kill other people. Obviously, it's more evil for the people involved in government, you know, the Nazis, you know, killing all those people. But still, when you have a society where millions of, or maybe it's not millions, maybe thousands, thousands or tens of thousands of people are deciding to kill themselves. In Canada, it's over 4% now. Same thing in the Netherlands and Belgium. It's over 4% of the people now are choosing euthanasia. That's over 4% of their deaths are coming from euthanasia. That suggests to me that there is a, I don't know the right word here,
There's something, there's a sickness or illness
yeah. or problem. Yeah, problem is the right way of saying it. In our culture that is driving people to this position that would have been unthinkable 100 or 200 years ago.
It would have been unthinkable, let's say, 40 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and the issue of compassion. Now, this is very odd because compassion means to suffer with. That's the root meaning of the term. And euthanasia isn't suffering with anybody. It's terminating the issue. True suffering with would be something like hospice care. People who are taking the time to provide services for people with difficulties, whether it's health, disability, or whatever. Euthanasia and assisted suicide isn't compassionate in that sense, and yet somehow they've managed to say, well, this is the compassionate approach. Why do you think people are beginning to look at killing as compassion more than they are apparently, at least some people, caring?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's comparing us to animals and seeing, well, it's a compassionate thing to do to an animal is to put it down rather than to have it go through pain and suffering. And so we have this notion that pain is evil. If death is simply a neutral thing that doesn't really have any key significance to a person, so whether you exist or not is irrelevant to the world or the cosmos or whatever, if there's no ultimate significance, purpose, meaning in human life, then it just seems like it, you know, dying is just another sort of ho-hum event, doesn't really, you know, make any difference in anything. So we know, and the person suffering, we know that's bad. We know they don't like that happening there. But what happens, of course, too, is that when a person is, a person is either killed through euthanasia or ingests pills through assisted suicide, is, of course, their autonomy, their being has either ended, or that's in the if you believe in a worldview in which, you know, there is no afterlife, then their autonomy is gone. It's ended. It's past. And so, interestingly, when people make the autonomy argument, which is one of the strongest philosophical arguments for assisted suicide, you're right, compassion is sort of the biggest public argument. But among philosophers, autonomy is the biggest argument. But really what happens is when you die with assisted suicide, your autonomy is ended at that point, unless you have an afterlife. And if you have an afterlife, that means there's also a different issue with autonomy. That means if you believe in afterlife, that typically a person who believes in afterlife also believes in a God. And so then there's a God who is has some control over you, because autonomy means your law to yourself, that you are your own law, that you can say what you say, what can be done. And that's why this notion of then, you know, allow the person to have the liberty, to freedom, you know, to be able to make their own choices about when they would end their life. But, you know, it's interesting because there's many, many cases where, you know, thinking about the issue of, you know, suffering versus, you know, ending the life, where we can't know what would happen one way or the other. So let me give you an interesting example here of a case where a person was motivated by compassion to try to help someone to live rather than to die of assisted suicide. And it ended in a way that was going to promote the welfare of that person. So there was a lady named Jeanette Hall in Oregon who was diagnosed with rectal cancer. And she was horrified by the prospect of the chemotherapy, because she hated the idea of losing her hair and the suffering that would go along with it, and, you know, the problems that are associated with chemotherapy. And she just thought she did not want to go through that. So she asked her physician for assisted suicide, which, by the way, is legal in Oregon. If you refuse treatment in Oregon, and refusing that treatment would cause you to die within 6 months, according to Oregon law, you can, and the Oregon Health and Human Services Department has verified this, that you are allowed to request assisted suicide. So her physician, who didn't believe in assisted suicide, instead of giving her a prescription for poison pills, went ahead and asked her some questions about her family and tried to get her to think about the social connections she had in this life. And she ultimately decided to go ahead and get chemotherapy. And 5 years later, so she was alive still 5 years later after getting chemotherapy, because it worked. The chemotherapy was able to deal with her rectal cancer. And so 5 years later, she saw the physician, and here's what she said to him. She said, "You saved my life. If I had gone to a doctor that believed in assisted suicide, I would not be here. I'd be dead."
That's an important story. And these kinds of stories, you know, I've, in my work, have found them and described them, but they don't seem to resonate in the same way that the stories of somebody like, say, Brittany Maynard, the young woman who had brain cancer and then became a poster person for legalizing assisted suicide, and deciding to commit suicide rather than go through hospice or even try to have her symptoms ameliorated in that sense. That had great impact for the public, and move the agenda forward. Yet the story that you just told, and there are others like it, seems to not resonate with people. Do you have a theory on why that might be?
Well, I think it's just the press is pushing I think the press is just pushing the one side of the agenda. I mean, the Brittany Maynard instance, for instance, during the Brittany Maynard episode, there actually was a young man who had the exact same disease that Brittany Maynard had. And he came out opposing assisted suicide and talking about how he was going to continue on with his family and do whatever he could do as long as he could, knowing that he was going to, you know, degenerate physically and such because of this neurological disease. But he didn't get much press time. You know, Brittany Maynard got all the press time. You know, she got all the covers of the magazines and everything because they're wanting to push that particular agenda. It's ironic too, because it's ironic too because the press actually has a lot of safeguards relating to suicide because of suicide prevention programs, and so when the press reports on things about suicide, they try not to glamorize it, and they try not to emphasize some of these points. But in the Brittany Maynard and assisted suicide, they throw that to the wind and promote it. And then it does become a thing where these ideas become not only thinkable, but then also even popular to engage in it. And you become sort of Brittany Maynard becomes a hero in the public image that's presented to her by the press and such.
CNN named Brittany Maynard one of the extraordinary people of 2014 because she killed herself.
Yeah.
That's why they did that.
Yeah.
And it's really quite remarkable. And people who ask for assisted suicide generally almost never receive suicide prevention services. I had the great honor of interviewing Dame Cecily Saunders, who created the modern hospice movement. Mm-hmm. And before the assisted suicide movement, hospice really was taking off in the public awareness and public understanding. And she was absolutely adamantly opposed to assisted suicide. She said it denigrated the intrinsic equal dignity of her patients. And yet that started in the 70s into the 80s. By the 90s and 2000s, we're told that hospice can't really help people. And some hospices cooperate with assisted suicide, and everything got turned on its head. And I think you're right. I think a lot of this has to do with media and popular culture and a neurotic fear of suffering that many people in our society have today.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you embrace the sort of utilitarian ideas that philosophers have been promoting since the time of the Enlightenment. I mean, Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century originated what people refer to as utilitarian philosophy, although he was building even upon the ancient Greek philosophies of Epicureanism and such. When you basically your philosophy of life is that the only thing that matters is gaining as much pleasure as possible and avoiding as much pain as possible, then euthanasia and assisted suicide start to make more and more sense. But if you realize that there are things in life that are far more important than that, and especially love, which is a word that doesn't get used a lot in these popular discourse. So they'll use words like compassion. And what about loving people? You know, if you realize that there's things like this that are far more important than these issues, then things begin to look very differently. And interestingly, right now, I have sort of personal experience in one respect of issues relating to end of life kind of issues, in that I'm the primary caregiver for my 91-year-old mother-in-law who has dementia. And she can't remember her children. She can't remember. And in fact, I my wife helps out too. And while I was gone on a 3-week trip doing research in Germany this past summer, when I got back, my mother-in-law didn't even know who I was. She, who are you? You know, I walk in and everything. Now she knows me day by day. But you know, people would look at her. Many people would look at her and say, well, what's the value of her life? You know, but you know what? I take her outside. She loves seeing flowers. She lights up when she still has an aesthetic sense to her, you know, and even if she didn't have those things, you know, she still is a human being. And, you know, it's interesting if you look at people like Peter Singer and others who promote this personhood theory and trying to, you know, say you have to have certain amount of rationality or certain amount of ability to plan the future. None of them can draw the line as to where that actually is. You know, how much rationality do you have in order to qualify as a person? How much ability to plan the future do you have to have? You know, what age of child, and by the way, their own theory actually implies that different children at different ages would achieve that level of whatever the rationality is. So there really is nowhere to draw a line there, which is why you have to draw the line at being a human. That's really the only logical place to draw the line. There's no other place you can draw it. Even if you say rationality, how much rationality?
It has to be an objective determination, not a subjective determination. With regard to autonomy, if autonomy is so important, then you cannot limit assisted suicide to the sick or people with disabilities. It has to be allowed for anybody who decides for whatever reason they want to die. And in Germany, by the way, a recent court ruling from the highest court in Germany literally ruled that that was a fundamental right. Committing suicide for whatever reason, not having to do with health, any reason that the patient, the person wants to die, wants, is a fundamental human right based on autonomy. That there is an ancillary fundamental human right to have assistance in a suicide, and another ancillary right to assist if you're asked. So in Germany, ironically, we are to the place where this movement has to lead, which eventually is death on demand. A lot of the activists try to pretend that's not it, and many may not want that. But based on their own arguments, I don't see how you avoid it.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree, because the issue of autonomy means that the person gets to decide, not the physician. The physicians don't get to decide. Right now, in Oregon, Washington, California, all the U.S. states that have assisted suicide, as well as Canada, physicians actually are the ones who have to decide whether or not you qualify, whether or not you meet the requirements. If there are requirements, that means it's not autonomy, because you're not the one deciding. The state is deciding what category of people can have it and which can't. And that's where it gets at the issue of equality that you already raised earlier, too. It's not the fundamentally, these assisted suicide laws are compartmentalizing certain people. In California, it's people who are in the last 6 months of terminal illness. And they're saying, we will not only allow you to commit suicide, we will help you to commit suicide. But if you are not in that category of people in the last 6 months of a terminal illness, we have suicide prevention programs that we're spending millions of dollars on to try to keep you from committing suicide. If you're a young person, you know, et cetera, we don't want you to commit suicide. So it isn't autonomy, and it isn't equality either in those cases. And you're right that most people are not just wanting to have the right to commit suicide. Everyone already can do that if they find some means to do that. I mean, there might be a few people that couldn't, because they might have some disability where they wouldn't be able to kill themselves. But the vast majority of people have some ability to kill themselves or other. You know, you can put a bag over your head or something. The people want to be killed by someone else, typically. And if you look at jurisdictions like the Netherlands or Belgium or Canada that have both euthanasia and assisted suicide, hardly anyone gets assisted suicide. They want the physician to do it. They don't want to do it themselves. They don't want to actually take the pills. They don't want to actually have to do it themselves. They want someone else to do it. Let the physician do it. And so we've got physicians involved then. And again, it's very sad that physicians have become involved in it because, of course, again, they're supposed to be a healing profession. They're supposed to be helping people to live better and healthier lives, not putting people to death. But unfortunately, the medical profession is what's people are pointing to get involved, and some are willing to do it, even though many are not.
There's a real irony here, isn't there? It's almost like I want assisted suicide as a vote of no confidence in medicine, and yet the very people that people may not have confidence in to care for them properly are willing to rely on them to end their lives. I just find that deeply ironic.
Yeah, it is very ironic, and some I've seen other bioethicists note that same particular thing, that, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, as people were as physicians were beginning to bring on different kinds of medical devices that would allow people to live longer, with sometimes diseases that earlier would have killed them off younger. So things like dialysis and other kinds of things like that coming on. Some people have sort of blamed the medical profession for keeping us alive too long. And now you're right. Now we're saying, oh, medical profession can be the remedy to that then by helping us end our lives all the earlier using these poisonous methods, either a syringe in case of euthanasia or pills.
Another irony is people don't have to accept those treatments. A doctor can't keep you alive too long if you say, no, I don't want those treatments, because people have a right to say no. If you don't want chemotherapy, you don't have to have chemotherapy. If you don't want to be on a respirator, you don't have to be on a respirator. And right. The euthanasia movement makes a great deal of effort to try to conflate those kinds of issues, so that if you decide you don't want to be in the ICU and you say no more and you die, well, that's the same thing as assisted suicide. But it isn't, because in the first case, it's a natural death and you may not die. In the second, it's certainly an unnatural death.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, you're right, that James Rachels is one of the philosophers who made that argument very strongly, and it's completely misguided because the issue has to do with intent. When you are withdrawing treatment, you're not doing that with the intent of wanting the person to die or hoping that they're going to die. You actually would be very happy if you withdraw the treatment and they continue living. But when you give them assisted suicide or euthanasia, you are wanting them to die. It's intentional.
And again, we're talking about the book Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing by Dr. Richard Weikert. And we're almost out of time, but I did not want to end the interview before I gave you the opportunity to suggest some of the positive ways forward that you suggest in the book. What can we do to try to alleviate this pressure to have people who are sick or disabled or mentally ill, because that's beginning to seep into this issue too, or people afraid of dementia, from choosing suicide or being killed instead of being cared for?
Well, again, I think one of the biggest issues is to try to get involved in these people's lives, whether it be family, friends, people that we know in various ways, get involved in their lives and try to spend time with them, interact with them. Again, I'm taking care of my mother-in-law, for example. She lives with us in our house. You know, while she has dementia, we haven't just institutionalized her to get her away from us or something like that. Because one of the things that a lot of the people said in the Oregon surveys also about why they get assisted suicide is not just they feel a burden on others, but because they feel like they don't have the capacity to do things that they enjoy anymore. And also, it's come about, even though this isn't something that they had actually answered in the surveys, it is clear from other statistical analyses that many of the people who request assisted suicide do so because they don't have close social ties, good family relations, and other things like that. So I think we just need to be to renew our love for other people, spend time with people, interact with them, even when it's hard. I mean, it's a sacrifice. It's not easy to do, but it's not easy for me, you know, and taking care of my mother-in-law. It's not always easy thing to do, but my wife and I can't go traveling, can't do a lot of other things sometimes we'd like to do. We do it, but we make that sacrifice because her life is valuable, and we're here to help her out and to sacrifice our wants and desires so that we can be a blessing to someone else in life. So it's looking at the other person, trying to make the sacrifices for them.
That's called love, as you described previously. Love is the answer to this issue. People afraid of being alone, people afraid of being a burden. These are very important issues, but they can be addressed. I also took care of my mother with the same circumstance you had, and I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the sense of it wasn't a burden at all. It was difficult, but she was my mother. Good grief. And I would not have had it any other way. And I also saw in that process, my wife and I caring for my mother who died at age 99 from Alzheimer's and so forth, how vulnerable she was. If I had been a pro-assisted suicide person, because she would have some moments of cogency, I could have gotten her through the process of assisted suicide, particularly if the doctor was one who wanted and believed in that approach. And so a lot of people are quite vulnerable at this time. In terms of opponents to assisted suicide, of course, it isn't just religious people. The disability rights community is adamantly opposed to assisted suicide, and they tend not to be religious. They tend to be secular in their outlook and not pro-life on abortion and this kind of thing. But they see themselves as the targets, and I think that's precisely correct.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, we're just done. This is a fascinating book, Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing. And it really has a good history lesson for all of us about how we got to the place where you see polls supporting euthanasia, assisted suicide, sick people and elderly people thinking they're a burden, which is a terrible thing to allow to happen. One last question. What next for Richard Weikert?
Well, interestingly, starting about 8 or 10 years ago, I decided to turn from the dark side to the light side. That is, most of my research up to this point has been on issues relating to social Darwinism, racism, eugenics, euthanasia, killing, all these kinds of things like that. And now I'm actually embarked on a project on religious revivals in the early 19th century Germany. And so I'm looking on the history of Christian revivals.
Well, that should be very interesting. I hadn't thought about revivals in Germany, but it'll be great to see when that book comes out. Yeah. Richard, thank you very much for being with us today, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.